You're listening to All Men Conversation. This event was recorded live via Zoom on May 20th, 2020. ALMA member and psychologist Jordana Jacobs moderated the discussion and was joined by Death Over Dinner founder Michael Hebb, psychotherapist, Zen teacher, and co-founder of New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care, Koshin Paley Ellison, and psychotherapist and grief advocate Megan Devine. ALMA is a network of mental health care providers dedicated to simplifying access to high-quality, affordable care. As members, therapists gain access to tools they need to grow and run a private practice, like insurance support, events and programming, and a community of their peers. Through this, ALMA has grown into a destination for people seeking care. To learn more about ALMA, visit helloalma.com.
I'm a practitioner at ALMA. I'm a clinical psychologist. I think the reason I was chosen to moderate this panel is because my research area is on the relationship between love and death, which in certain senses has never been more clear or maybe more important to discuss than it is right now. Michael, how about we start with you? Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, that sounds great. So my name is Michael Hebb, and about 8 years ago, I started a project called Let's Have Dinner and Talk About Death. Deathoverdinner.org is what it's affectionately known as. And there have been about a million people who've sat down and had those conversations as a result. And I've been able to be at many of those conversations, many conversations about end-of-life wishes, mortality. And I wrote a book called Let's Talk About Death Over Dinner. And I'm about to launch a very large platform called the End of Life Collective, which is a single source for all end of life planning and services and community.
Thank you. How about you, Megan?
I am Megan Devine. I'm an author and a psychotherapist and a grief educator. Michael, you started with like your timeline here. So I founded Refuge in Grief a little over 8 years ago. And my book is It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. That's all I'll say for now.
Great. Koshin?
Hi, everybody. It's really nice to be here. So my name's Koshin. I'm also an author and a Zen monk and a Jungian psychotherapist and the co-founder with my husband of the New York Zen Center for Contemplative Care, which is a nonprofit educational organization that trains clinicians and lay people how to be intimate at the bedside and in their lives. And we also provide direct care. And over the last 13 years, we've cared for about 100,000 people at the bedside. And I'm just delighted to be here with all of you and to learn. So happy to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Okay. So I'm going to just start asking some questions. I hope that we can all just communicate around them, even though they're sort of segmented and pointed towards one of you at a time. So feel free to jump in. But the first question is for Michael. Sort of starting with the obvious, why is it important to talk about death, especially now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we could spend several hours just discussing that. I'll relate it quickly to a topic that we're more comfortable with, and that's food. In this country, we saw a great forgetting around how to cook for ourselves, how to farm, how to garden, how to feed ourselves when we industrialized food. The same thing happened with death and dying. We over-medicalized death and dying. We forgot that as a human act, we forgot that death is a community act. It's not a medical act. Keeping people alive is. So as we medicalized and over-medicalized death, so many of us forgot the ancient and the long-standing wisdom and the importance of this conversation. And I think it's probably the most essential conversation there is. It is what defines us. But since we have clinicians primarily, I think, in this audience, I think it's important to note that as clinicians, I believe it's very important that you have literacy, that you have comfort around this topic. Your patients, whether you're a nurse or whether you're a therapist or a doctor or any way you're interacting with someone these days, it's top of mind. And if you're not comfortable with the topic. If you're not literate, if you're not clear about your own fears and triggers, your patients and the people that you're interacting with are going to feel it. And I'll give one example around that. We have worked very closely with the Cleveland Clinic and Memorial Sloan Kettering, but I was invited to create a dinner for heart surgeons at the Cleveland Clinic. And the initial response was, and this is where they were first successfully performed heart transplant surgery. Heart surgeons don't like talking about death. They like beating death. And what I saw was at first resistance, and then one medical director deciding that it was important to have this conversation. And then to watch as table after table of heart surgeon / physician assistant, the nurses that support them, these care teams, just breaking into tears and connecting and knowing that that group of people would treat each other differently in the medical suite, but they would also be more open to having the conversation with the parent, with the family, and with the patients. And so the amount of suffering that goes down when we have these conversations, when we make ourselves literate, is it's maybe the area where we can reduce suffering in the greatest way, you know, of anything, anywhere we can focus our time is, you know, I guess my somewhat slanted view. So I'll hand it back to you, Jordan.
You know, I'm just thinking that that's a wonderful answer, and also wondering how the conversation around death has changed now, given that we're living in a COVID era.
Yeah, the thing that has changed, well, there's many things that have changed that are not positive. This is already a difficult conversation. It's just got more difficult. It is more top of mind for more people, but the conversation itself requires even more skill, generosity, presence, especially because of our distancing protocols. So it hasn't become easier. It has become more top of mind. It has become more present in people's lives. The one thing I think that we do have going for ourselves is it's not an outlier conversation. It's not a fringe conversation anymore. It's completely reasonable for a family to make an end-of-life plan. It's logical. It doesn't require somebody who's the squeaky wheel who's saying, we should talk about this, we should talk about this. It's obvious now. Everyone needs a plan. And that we're experiencing a tremendous amount of anxiety culturally, personally. And making a plan and knowing that you know what your loved ones want and what you want and it's been communicated is one of the best ways to alleviate anxiety. So surrender all you want to COVID and to the great mystery of life, but also make a plan. So that's why I'd say it's important now and how it's changed.
Yeah. I see Megan and Koshin nodding. I'm wondering if either of you want to add anything to sort of the general question of why it's important to talk about death and why is it even maybe more important now or how the conversation has changed.
I keep thinking to myself, like, amen, brother, right? Like that reduction of suffering is really the work that so many of us do here, right? Like this isn't about making a hard conversation not be hard anymore or making death and dying or grief itself any easier. It's about applying skills to it so that we can reduce suffering, right? And I love that last thing that you said there, Michael. It's like we want to be able to rest in whatever that mystery is, that yes, death is part of life and grief is part of being human. And we don't want to have just that one side. We also need to, like, it's like, you know, takes two wheels to make something go. And if you only have one wheel, it just goes in circles, right? And so that mystery and that natural acceptance, and let's really talk about this. Let's talk about the skills that are needed and the communication and relationship skills that are needed in both of these spaces. And I say both of these spaces because we often lump grief in with death and dying, and they are not the same thing. And grief is, when it's talked about in the death and dying space, it's almost exclusively in that let's find the right rituals to support grief as though that's the end of the process instead of the beginning of the process. So I love having these conversations where we bring almost both of the wheels of loss into it, right? The frank discussion about death and dying and a frank discussion about what it is to lose what we love. So I love these conversations and similar to what Michael said, like this is about reducing suffering, right? Reducing overwhelm and fears of the unknown and the awkwardness that comes with being human, trying to have a relationship with other humans. How do we reduce that suffering by having honest discussions and applying skills where skills are necessary?
Well, I just feel an enormous amount of tenderness and I feel like right now, I don't know if you can hear it, but there's an ambulance outside my window. And we live very close to several hospitals. So all through this time, you know, that sound has been coming. And actually, the person who assists myself and Chodo is a EMT person. And so he tells us a lot about what that's like and the fear. And I think to me, what is unique about this time is like what has always been true about how truly vulnerable we are is just like the mirror is just unflinchingly close. And I feel so much tenderness for the heartbreak and the fear that many people are experiencing. And the physicians, you know, in our community, there are a number of physicians who are the ones who are holding the hands of people as proxy for their family members who can't hold their hands. And another person that we know is, you know, putting bodies into trash bags because they'd have run out of body bags, and the devastation of that feeling of literally putting bodies into trash bags. So I think that there's this time that we're in this time, which is a really powerful and temporal mirror that gives us the opportunity to actually embrace how vulnerable we truly are. And for me, I feel that very regularly and, you know, in working with all the different kinds of people that I work with and just feeling how afraid and the trembling experience that most people are having around, you know, on the surface, economic and sometimes food issues, like where's the food? And then, but under it is really this fear of like, my goodness, I could never be able to say goodbye to the people I love. And if I get sick, you know, Chodo and myself have had this conversation, my husband of 18 years, if one of us gets sick, even now, we may not see each other again, that we would be taken away in a sound like that ambulance. And the potential is very real. And it, to me, it's an amazing to look at like what is not done. You know, have I said everything that I need to say? It's, you know, this work of the unfinished business to me is the incredible opportunity in the midst of this vulnerability. So how do we find the stillness to really root down into our values and our love and our tenderness so that we can widen out so that if we are taken in that ambulance, we can say goodbye and not wait. So that, I mean, those are some of the things I'm thinking about right now. I'm just so happy to be with all of you.
Yeah, so beautifully shared, Ocean. Thank you. I have been thinking very similarly. And the phrase that keeps coming to mind to me is that the veil has been lifted. The
totally.
Veil has been lifted. And the separation between life and life's fragility is so clear. It's always there. It's always been there. And I think that's part of why it's been so important to talk about death and to not avoid it and to get prepared and to be as skilled as possible when it comes to these conversations and into the preparation. But yes, now more than ever, the veil is lifted and we can see it so clearly. We can hear it in the ambulance right outside. It's a very interesting time. I'm reminded, looking at Harry's picture here also, that this was a conversation we were always planning on having at Alma. We've been planning this for a long time. And to have this conversation now is particularly poignant, which leads me to my next question, which is specifically for Megan, but of course, Michael and Koshin, please weigh in. I might weigh in as well, because it's really a question, Megan, about how you support your clients through grief and loss at a time like this, and also through Zoom, right? How that changes things, what challenges you've faced and potentially unique opportunities for healing can be offered by doing therapy in sort of in someone's home or in their bed or, you know, whatnot.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time. So a lot of the conversation sort of out in the world and in media is how has grief changed in the pandemic? And sort of my top answer is it hasn't changed, right? we may be thinking about it more as a community, as a wider culture. We may be voicing it more, which is really wonderful. Like Koshin, what you said, you know, that the moment asks us to have those conversations and to feel into what it will be like living on after the people we love die. And I think that's why we avoid talking about grief, or why we reach for things like stages and systems and tangible concrete markers for recovery inside grief, because otherwise we have to sit with what it feels like to live without our people. And that's deeply uncomfortable. And I think the work that so many of us do is helping people become comfortable sitting in that nightmare without flinching, without trying to change it, without trying to talk yourself out of it. So when we talk about how has grief changed inside the pandemic, I still go back to it hasn't. We're talking about it a lot more because a lot more people are losing, right? Not just losing people to the virus, but also losing livelihoods, losing hope for the future, losing identity, all of these different losses that, of course, many of us who work in this field, like we see the incoming waves of grief of so many kinds, and that is overwhelming, right? So many ripple effects from what's happening. So I actually don't see individual clients anymore. I do a lot of training and a lot of teaching and creating online spaces for grieving people. And what's really neat about that during this time is I get to see what people who were grieving before the pandemic and people whose loss happened either because of the virus or alongside the virus, how grieving people are sort of processing what's happening in the outer world. One of the really interesting things is that for folks whose loss predates the pandemic, a lot of them are saying, finally, the outside world matches the inside world, right? When you lose somebody, it's like the world should stop, right? What's that Auden poem, like stop all the clocks, right? Like the outside world should stop. Well, now the outside world has stopped. And for a lot of grieving people, the pandemic feels in alignment, right? They're also aware of the dichotomy of that. Like more people suffering means that I feel more aligned with the outside world. But it's really interesting to hear that. It's also really interesting to hear both people who were grieving before the pandemic and newly grieving people feeling like their own personal loss has been erased by the cultural loss, by the communal loss. And then the added suffering that comes on top with not being able to be at the bedside of somebody or not being able to do those community touch points like rituals and sitting Shiva together. It's taking what can be a very lonely and intense, disorienting experience and magnifying it. And what we saw, what I saw before the pandemic is still true during the pandemic, is that we need each other to survive. We need each other to lean on in hard times. And unfortunately, we don't really talk about what it means to support somebody inside their grief without trying to fix it for them or take it away or push them towards a resolution or a transformation. And we're seeing that. I think one of the interesting things that's happening, because death and loss and grief are sort of in our face right now, we can't get away from it. And so these conversations that are happening in the media about naming grief for what it is, wherever that is on the spectrum of loss, from, you know, not being able to go to graduation up to not being able to be at the bedside of your person while they're dying, I think it's sort of taken the illusion away that we can cheer each other up, right? There's so many of us in pain and losing things, and it's almost like we have to take off that costume of pretending we know how to fix it, because we can't, right? And I know that that's painful. And for a lot of us in these fields, myself and my friends and my allies and my colleagues, it's almost like we've been working to have this cultural conversation about death and dying and connectedness and intimacy and grief. We've been working towards this for a really long time, and this is not the way we wanted to have the conversation. And yet the moment is here. How do we talk about this? How do we talk about how we show up for each other when we can't fix what's broken? There's not an answer for that. And I love going back to, Michael, what you said about suffering, right? Like our role here is, how do we help each other reduce suffering by the ways we show up for each other? When we create pathways for people to be truly supportive and amazing to each other, they are amazing to each other. And I think, you know, I was having a conversation with some of my students yesterday about my issue with the term in real life, right? Like we connect with people in real life, or we connect with them on the screen. And I think that does our virtual connections a disservice. There are connections for people, especially grieving people who very often feel lonely or misunderstood or overly pathologized or corrected, the connections that they make inside spaces where it's okay to be in the pain that you're in are deep family connections. They're deep relationships. They may not be geographically proximal. They might not be able to go out to tea together whenever things resolve enough to do that safely again, but they're family for each other. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways we can stop pitting the two against each other as though it were a binary, right? Binaries don't work for most things human. But to talk about like, how do we meet the needs for connection in whatever means possible? And what does that connection really look like when we stop trying to fix each other? What does it look like when we acknowledge the truth of another person's experience without that agenda, whether overt or covert, of trying to make things better for them, right? What kind of connection and community can we create given all the tools at hand, whether those are in person or virtual or via the screen? And I think that's a really, to borrow language from you, Koshin, a really tender and beautiful communal experiment to run. How do we create ways to have intimate connection, acknowledging the reality of how hard it is to be here? Let's use all of the platforms that we have, all of the ways of connecting.
Yeah, thank you for sharing all of that. There's so much that I want to comment on, but I think I'm going to direct my next question actually towards Koshin, who I'm just a little curious about your work right now.
Just a little.
I'm quite overwhelmingly curious actually about your experience at, you know, quote unquote bedside with many people. I know that's the work that you do typically, you know, helping people really in the moments before their death and helping the family and friends and loved ones following. And I imagine that's in certain ways changed. I don't mean to dichotomize or to pit Zoom against in real life, but I am wondering about what your experience has been like helping people die in a time when you can't just hold their hand and be with them in their suffering in the same way, how you've shifted to still be with them, as Megan said, you know, anyway, in spite of it, and maybe more so at times because of the distance.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. What I've seen in myself is I have this bias towards what I used to call in-person and meetings. And we've had the privilege of walking people through, you know, Megan was talking about all the different forms of loss, like oftentimes with serious illness is the, you know, people will lose their primary care doctor and then they will lose their specialist team. And then they and their family will lose their palliative care team, and then they will lose their and then the loved ones lose the hospice team. And so we've often been that kind of that continuity of care and support through that whole process. And what's amazing is that we've also been able to do that through screens. And that for me, one of the interesting things has been really to kind of lean in and to really, like, for example, right now I'm looking at you and feeling just like really noticing your facial expressions and really noticing your breath in your body. And I've been noticing how important that has been to like really feel like go beyond the coldness of the glass and warm the space. And for me, when I'm able to do that, then I can really actually be with you. But I find that there's an easy way to kind of back up. And so like, for example, Chodo has been taking care and walking a woman and her daughter through their dying on Zoom. And, you know, they're holding the tablet, you know, in her bed, you know, as she's dying and talking about her experience, and then passing it to the daughter and having this conversation together. And, you know, also we've been, you know, participating and holding Shiva calls for grief and leading memorial services. And I even actually created a, did a marriage over Zoom. And during this time, you know, where some people realized, wow, if this is it, let's do it. What are we waiting for to commit? And, you know, so I feel like that there's also this delicious urgency during this time, you know, as we've been all kind of talking about. And like, how do we really kind of keep thinking about the tenderness and just how do we keep staying close to the tenderness? Because this time won't last. And so as you were saying, Jordana, like this amazing time where the veil is lifted, yeah, and it will come down again and we will forget, as they say, you know? And so it's like the Gordon, the angel comes and touches here, mm-hmm. right there. And we will forget how precious and tenuous life is. So how do we grieve fully? How do we, you know, really hold the people that we love? And how do we grieve with them? And not just right after the person dies, but weeks later and months later, check in with them. So, and we've been able to really do all of that through Zoom. And the amazing thing too is we're doing bereavement groups, which we usually do, contemplative basic bereavement. But this is the first time we have multiple groups at the same time, and they're global grief groups. We have people from almost every continent in each of these groups. I mean, it's amazing. So people from Africa and Asia and South America and the United States even, you know, all but all grieving together. I mean, it's quite amazing. And for all of them, we're like, wow, you know, like, and with their horror and together. And it's like, there's something about the kind of global nature of it that, you know, see people from all over the world on your screen and realize like all of them are holding a horror, a grief, a brokenness, and are shattered. And there's something very healing about warming into that cold space or warming the cold glass. And how do we do that for each other? To me, I feel like we're doing that right now.
Absolutely.
I mean, like, I feel it. Yeah.
I feel it from here. So, you know, it's happening now. It's a beautiful thing that you're, I find myself saying, okay, well, how, Megan, how, Koshin, how do we really sit with each other and really feel each other? It's great to be able to point to this moment and say, well, okay, this is how it's done.
This is how we do it.
Yeah.
All day, no. But I think like building on that, that I think that when we create spaces for real connection to happen, for acknowledgement to happen, then the awesome arrives, right? It really is about creating the container and creating, honestly, it's like one of those like good boundaries make for good communities, good rules make for good communities, and creating. So I see this a lot in my communities, right? Like they first come in and the ground rules and the ways that we speak to each other feel a little bit weird because it's not the way we normally do things in the outside world. Mm-hmm. But pretty soon people start realizing like, oh, if I can't give advice, if I can't cheer you up, if I can't take over your story with my story, if we can all sort of take off our Medusa hats and let the snakes be free, treating each other beautifully arises, right? I've seen it happen so many times. If you give people that opportunity to be amazing, they're amazing. Like 98% of the time, because humans are still going to human. But so I was actually having the same conversation with folks yesterday about what is it about our online communities, our online spaces, the safety of the screen that makes, in some ways, intimacy easier. And they had some cool things to say. And one of them was like, when I go to an in-person support group, I feel called on, right? Like the facilitator is going to point to me at some point and say, you haven't shared yet today, Sandy. And there's a safety behind the screen that lets a lot of people feel more willing to be present, to look into the eyes of the person who's speaking once they understand where the eyes of the person is on the screen. But there's that same sort of function, I think, that happens where people are incredibly cruel or rude or impolite in the comments section online, I think that functions in the opposite direction as well, that there is a dissolving of that hesitation to connect sometimes. Again, given the right boundaries and the right container and the right environment, people really do want to relate and connect and acknowledge each other. And it's interesting to think about, like, the social researcher, right? Like the social scientist, why is that in online spaces that these things feel this or this way? And I think part of it is that the novelty of it, right? I've been talking to a lot of folks who said that the virtual funerals or the virtual shivas that they've been part of touched them in a deeper way than the in-person memorials that they've attended. And if you think about, like, why would that be, right? I'm definitely not a neurobiologist, but thinking about anything that we know how to do, I think that there's an expectation and a habitual response that comes in. It doesn't mean that we're not moved by in-person funerals or memorials, but that we know how to do them. And we don't know how to do this online. We don't know how to create those spaces or to connect and tell the truth and show up for each other vulnerably. And because of the novelty paired with the intense emotion and the humanness of it, I think that can set the stage for a really powerful connection, that warming the screen that you talk about, Koshin. I love that phrase. I wrote down delicious urgency because I'm going to use that. That almost desperate need to connect right now, since we don't have the distractions of our normal routines, since we can't physically lean on each other, that roaring need for connection is louder, right? And I think those two things, the need and the novelty, combining to make a really interesting and unique time for us.
Yeah, we don't have a conditioned defensive response yet. So we are more raw and vulnerable, potentially. Yeah. But you talked about virtual funerals, and I'm very familiar with Michael's work, and I know he's been doing a lot in that sphere. And Michael, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the COVID white paper that you helped create. So I think that would be a really good resource for this community.
Yeah, well, I happen to be sharing space with three of the collaborators and one of the editors. So a group of about 80 end-of-life leaders came together organically as soon as the lockdown started and realized that everything was going to change from a dying alone perspective, a funeral perspective, but also wanting to give people tools for grieving while they are isolated. And we kind of magnificently, that 80 people from across the spectrum, including medical leaders that and funeral directors and death doulas and people that don't necessarily work together. Medical directors don't work with funeral directors very often. They don't talk to each other very often about how they can collaborate. And so we saw this erasing of these boundaries and this incredible generosity happen. And the resource is a living resource. It just went live. It's covidwhitepaper.com. And it's there for professionals, and there'll be a layperson version. But the one thing that I was thinking about is hearing about warming the screen and thinking about Zoom. And I don't see patients, so I can't speak to it from that perspective. But I have been holding virtual death dinners. And I'm, like Koshin, was very biased around this idea of in-person. The visceral, the human, the smell of, like, the smell of the fire and the sizzle of the food and the sensuality of being human. And that was just all of this opportunity for transformation, and combine that at a dinner and have people talk about death. And it sounds like perfection to me. But realizing that as I've watched, and I didn't want to do a virtual death dinner, it sounded awful. They've been probably more powerful than the other death dinners that I've ever hosted. And we break people into tables of about six or seven. And one of the reasons I think that Megan and Koshin have, you, Jordan, have detailed several of the reasons that have made, that make it a more impactful in a different way. I think one of the primary reasons is social anxiety. Those of us who create these experiences tend to be pretty good at human experiences with other people. We kind of forget how difficult it is for someone to show up to a shiva, to someone to show up to a funeral, to someone to show up to a dinner. We have so much social anxiety in this culture. And I've been watching people feel just seem and being so more embodied and more present in front of their screen than they've ever seen them be at a table. And, you know, so that's I think that that's a huge part of what the opportunity is. And it's a little bit like, damn, I wish we didn't learn that lesson, right? Because like, the more we realize how socially anxious we are, the less that we'll probably put social connection on this like incredible, you know, high moral ground or goal for all people, and just realize, no. This is a great way to connect. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword, this lesson.
One of the comparisons that I've been doing lately, which doesn't actually land very well, but I'm going to use it anyway, is the difference between carob and chocolate. And what I'm finding is people no longer know what carob is. But I think that we have this, the screen-based connection is the booby prize. It's the unwanted consolation prize that you get because you can't have the quote unquote real thing. And, you know, we did that to carob in the 80s, which was considered like the healthy alternative to chocolate. And if you try to make carob chocolate, you're going to be disappointed. But if you let carob be what it is, it's tasty. Right. And if we continually like put the virtual world as the consolation booby prize, I think people might approach it as a booby prize instead of being like, how does this medium allow us to serve that need for human connection? And Michael, that whole social anxiety thing is huge, right? Like, again, it's that piece of what does the screen allow us to do? Even though functionally it's not true that you're more kind of quote unquote protected behind a screen than you are in person, but the barriers to entry are lower and you can turn your camera off and you don't have to speak if you don't want to. And somebody else pointed out to me, if somebody is getting married or there's a funeral or a wake and they can't afford the plane ticket to come out, they can usually access Zoom. They might have to go somewhere else if financially they can't afford the internet access or they don't have the technology, so nothing is perfect. But what barriers get reduced or come down when we decide to make these warm spaces online? How do we let, you know, what, like, I'm willing to be surprised by the beauty and the benefit of warm virtual spaces and who literally gets a seat at the table, who might not have had a seat at the table previously. That's a really interesting conversation to have in any sphere, right? Mm-hmm. Who's not at the table and why? And what are some interesting ways that we might make the table bigger? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and just also thinking a little bit about what Michael said and the social anxiety, what makes us more anxious than death and loss and grief? Not, in my opinion, nothing. And so for us to be able to have these, perhaps it's Zoom and perhaps it's these digital connections that's allowing us to go deeper into the topic that would typically cause us the most anxiety and the most avoidance.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still going to put public humiliation higher than people's fear of death. But to that point, I think that Zoom actually reduces the likelihood of public humiliation. So, like, when you go to a dinner party or a live event, there's many more opportunities for you to make a fool of yourself.
we can actually connect fear of humiliation. If you cook that back further, fear of public humiliation means that I will no longer be part of the community, and being alone without community means death. So there you go.
Yeah.
Still connected to fears of death. All right.
So I'm mindful.
The therapist answer.
Do you think that people will become more comfortable talking about grief after this pandemic? Anyone feel free to answer.
I'm going to say undoubtedly. I don't know if Megan's going to agree with me.
No, I'm always the contrarian, aren't I? All right, here's what I think. I think I agree with Koshin that we forget. I think we forget. And I think whether the ways that we talk about grief or that we talk about grief at all, I think whether it continues once the pandemic has resolved depends on the skill we bring to the conversation now. If we can have honest conversations that normalize the human experience of grief without skipping over it or pathologizing it or deciding that it's a medical condition that needs to be fixed, all of the ways that we pre-pandemic deal with grief, I think if we can have better conversations about it now, we stand a better chance of deeply revolutionizing the way that we come to grief in this culture, not because of the pandemic, but because of the pandemic, right? That this has brought this conversation about loss and how frequent loss enters our lives across that whole continuum, I do think that we can, that we stand a chance of changing things and making things better, not only for grieving people who are grieving a death, but also for those of us who really truly want to be of service to the people we care about, whether that's our clients or family members or the world at large, right? Like, I think we have that desire to be of service to those in pain. We have been taught the wrong ways to do that. And if we can have really blunt and clear and honest discussions about how we care for our own pain and for others' pain, then yeah, I think that we can reach whatever the other side of this is, having made decades worth of progress in a relatively short time. I try to be hopeful about that, right? And I think it takes all of us being willing to have that conversation. And when you hear the spark of that conversation, fanning that baby into flames, how do we get some actionable skills in there? How do we help people have the conversations that they need to have? And then for me, it's like when you give people ways to have these conversations, and then they get to feel the benefit of acknowledging somebody else's pain instead of trying to fix it, it's like that feeds itself, right? When we help people have, when we help people deliver their good intentions better and with more skill, then the feedback loop becomes like, wow, I actually do feel more connected to my person, and they trust me more with the intimate contours of their own hearts. Like, that makes you want to do more of the awkward thing. So how are we going to guide that more people get to feel the benefit of having these awkward conversations so that they want more of it once the fire hose of pain slows down a little bit? So cautiously optimistic through the application of skills and practice.
I would just add, I'm sure it's a possibility, but I think for at least 40,000 years as a species, we have moved away from discomfort of all kinds. And sometimes we kill what makes us uncomfortable. Sometimes we have, you know, created cultures that hide what we don't want to deal with or feel uncomfortable or awkward around, or that cause pain. And so to me, you know, one possibility is learning just to have a different relationship with pain, whether it's grief or sorrow or the desire to feel heard in our wail. And can we risk wailing and allowing other people to hear us? And so to me, I'm deeply interested in how do we create community around courage, and where we can say, I can be here, you know, in the Zen tradition and Buddhist tradition, there's a bodhisattva called Avalokiteshvara, and her name means the one who hears all the cries of the world. And so to me, it's like, and she is the one who holds that image of compassion. So compassion is like the one who's just willing to sit there. If I'm willing to be with you and to hear your cries, even in your breath. And so for me, my wish for this world is for us to remember what compassion is, which is not to fix and run in and say, oh, you'll feel better and it's going to be okay, because actually you have no idea. And what's so great about being okay? I'll never forget this one woman that, you know, right after we bathed her husband and shrouded him, and as we were actually just finished bathing him, she stayed alone with him in the bathroom and pounded her chest and was wailing. And it still moves me. And just, and many people wanted to rush in and like, she doesn't sound okay. And I was like, she sounds amazing. And so how do we make a world where there's space to realize that's incredible, to wail in grief and pound our chests? And I love that kind of world. And I also love the world where we're afraid of it. So how do we learn to love both sides?
Yeah. I think we probably have time for one more question. Somebody asked, I had one friend that spoke about how the virtual funeral she attended was really beautiful, but then after it, grieving alone at home felt heavier than ever. Do you have thoughts or tools to offer for this intense solitude?
We need each other's faces and voices. And we are social creatures. And as Michael and Megan were talking about earlier, like, as a friend of mine likes to say, a lonely monkey is a dead monkey. And to be alone after those memorials and funerals is very painful. And so what I've been suggesting to people is just like put someone on Zoom or FaceTime and just say, I can't speak. I'm just going to lay on the couch. And can you just be here with me? We can read a book or whatever, but can we just be together? And maybe we'll talk and maybe we won't. So to, you know, we need each other's voices and each other's ears changes us. We need to see, wow, look at your face and I love what's happening with your eyes and with your mouth. Like we actually regulate each other. We attune with each other to kind of go back to Megan's the tuning fork, you know, this kind of idea of like, how do we attune to what is happening? And actually being together in that space is really how we do that. And so how do we step forward and just rest and not have to do anything, but to say, I need someone and can you be that person for me? I don't need you to do anything, but maybe hear my cry.
Thank you so much for listening. To learn more about events, programming, and other membership perks at Alma, visit helloalma.com or email membership@helloalma.com. That's helloalma.com.